This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Let me just provide a brief summary. Some of this was in the film, but I'll just go through very quickly. The UW system state funding has been cut by $362 million since 2012. Tuition has been frozen at that time as well. In 2011, as you saw in the film, Act 10, also known as the Wisconsin Budget Repair Bill, stripped union rights from state workers, including faculty and K-12 teachers. Governor Scott Walker laid out a series of specific proposals in 2015, which included more budget cuts as well as a change to tenure and governance in what he called the Act 10 for Higher Education. During his run for presidency in 2015, Walker submitted a budget proposal that included language that would have changed the century-old mission of the University of Wisconsin system, known as the Wisconsin Idea, by removing the words that commanded the university to search for truth and improve the human condition, and replacing them with meet the state's workforce needs. As you saw, after public outroar, the governor retracted the changes, saying they were simply the result of a drafting error. All UW system employees have seen their wages fall over the last 7 years. First came furloughs without pay in 2010, and then take-home pay was cut because UW employees, like other state employees, were required to cover a larger share of their health insurance premiums and to contribute to more to their pensions starting in 2011. Tenure has been eroded via a policy that enables administrators ultimate authority over faculty members post-tenure review. The university says the proposed change is merely a formality, but many professors disagree. Spending on research at UW-Madison declined by more than $100 million between 2012 and 2015, leading the university to fall from the top five of the National Science Foundation's ranking of research institutions for the first time in more than four decades. These are just some of the facts of the situation in Wisconsin. So, Lane, let's talk a little bit about what happened and the lessons learned from the late, great state of Wisconsin. So first, we've heard about this in the film, but I thought it would be useful for the audience to hear you just talk a little bit about what is the philosophy and who are the players behind cutting state support for higher education in Wisconsin. While many of us are aware of the problems in our own state, many are unaware of the problems, scale, and reach.
Yeah, so I think for me that question of what is the philosophy is one of the more interesting ones of this. That is, fundamentally, I find it really problematic the way that language frames these narratives, right? So, just the fundamental shift that's happened to think of students as the consumer. Or, what's the product there? If we're using these business metaphors, which we seem kind of forced to do, what's the product? Is the product the education, or is the product somehow the person? Who's the line worker? What's the production field? Is that the new knowledge, or is that the faculty member? Who are the owners? The whole narrative arc is problematic, and I think that it needs to be resisted fundamentally at that level. That is, we need to assert the kind of humanity of education and the essential kind of messiness of education, right? I mean, I balk at the idea that somehow education can be, should be, or needs to be efficient, right? All of these words like reform. So it is formed, and then it needs to be reformed into something else. But the word reform is very difficult to argue. That is, someone comes and says, the faculty is standing in the way of these new reforms. Well, so that makes faculty look like a kind of weird old guard conservative presence within the necessity of this kind of new revolution. But think about that. It's really odd because the conservative point is to conserve, is a relationship with a received tradition. And academic institutions, as you could see, including where we stand here, has long traditions, some longer than others, but long traditions. So the conservative stance is a philosophical stance that deliberates on those, but also supports them. The radical stance is this strategic disruption. So we see all of these kind of language things, and both, you know, I'm in a field of language, but we see all of this framing and narrative and language work that fundamentally makes it very difficult to even kind of engage in a defense, because once you have to defend this, you're already in a weakened state.
Well, it's like the comment in the film, you know, oh, thank God it's only $250 million that they're cutting us. They were talking about so much more.
We saw that. I mean, that so just last year, the cut was to be $300 million. There was a very public interaction with the head of our regents, the director of the Board of Regents, where one of our colleagues at the time publicly said, "Mr. Cross, if you are not able to get that cut reduced, will you have done your job?" And he said, "No, I would not have done my job. I assure you, you know, it is my job to get that cut reduced." And he went on to say, "Then would you step down from your job if you don't get that cut reduced?" And Mr. Cross said, "Yes, I will step down from that job if I do not get this cut reduced." So it did get reduced from $300 million to $250 million. And that $50 million increment was the success. You know, we looked at that as success, and the press, my colleagues didn't, but the press looked at that as, you know, what a gift to the university system. So that dynamic was absolutely accurate. That is, they throw a number out. We'll you know, $500 million cuts. And then, wow, we succeeded to only get half of that, right? So we were punished, or, you know, less, or, but.
Well, one of the things that I know that we both experienced in the state of Wisconsin is that these cuts to higher education affected different institutions differently in the state. So I just wanted you to say a little bit about, you know, in the University of Wisconsin, it's a 26-campus system. But the situation is different for an institution like Lane and I taught at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, the urban campus in the state's largest city, one of the only two doctoral institutions and Research One institutions, that would be Madison, the land grant, and Milwaukee, the urban public. But I just wanted you to reflect or talk a little bit about how these cuts affect these institutions differently. So, for instance, I can remember a year and a half ago when 2 years ago these cuts were being proposed, that Madison was worrying about letting go of its golf course, where we were losing schools, full programs. And, of course, the effects of these cuts on K-12 education have also been fairly intense. So I wanted you just to say a little bit about, I mean, even in the film where they're saying, well, there's football. And I'm not kidding you. I would read articles where they say, you know, Madison is great because there's that football. We got to support that.
True. Good basketball, too. It's absolutely true that the cuts go through the system, But the players in the system are very unequal. So in our case, a flagship like Madison already has so much external funding, so much money, so much ties with private industry, with patents, with corporations. They're a land grant institution. So when there's a cut, but also a lack of leadership that distinguishes between the levels of cuts for different places. That is, it creates a kind of formula-based cut where it says, well, you know, you're 30% of the system budget, so you'll take, you know, that requisite amount of cut to your budget, and on down the road. A place like Madison, can absorb it in a much different way than a place like my institution and her previous institution, and we can absorb it in a much different way than a really small 2-year program that might be upstate somewhere. And I know that the California system's an extremely complex one with different layers of funding in the different kind of I don't know if they're hierarchies exactly, but the different levels within the system. So it would be similar to that, but quite a bit smaller. But it's been devastating to public education, K through 12. They've had a much worse time of it because the assault on public, especially urban education, is even more profound.
So what tactics and strategies have worked and not worked in contesting these changes?
Yeah.
What was your experience working with faculty, students, and even administrators to push back? What works and what didn't work as you reflect on it now?
So, yeah, I've gotten really active as an activist, kind of doing street work and grassroots work and movement building and trying to build cultures of resistance in, you know, outside of my job as a professor. This is a really difficult thing to fight because, for one thing, institutions, there are multiple voices, there are multiple levels of voices within the institution. The other thing, by nature, and Carville said this at the end of this movie, professors are generally deliberative in their nature. That is, they're not really usually people that want to kind of storm the barricades and look at labor actions and direct action and, you know, teach-ins, teach-outs, walk-outs, whatever. So it's been difficult. One of the things that I think is really important is to look at the kind of spectrum of engagement that students have, that staff has, that professors have, that faculty has, and that community has, and kind of figure out where these levers are that need to be engaged. So in that way, I got very involved in faculty governance and in speaking out when you can, and things like Senate or figuring out how the rules work so you have a voice. Students, oddly enough, I've ended up feeling that students actually have a lot more power than we do. Our administrators listen more to bodies of students than they do to the faculty. So I tell students at UW-Milwaukee that y'all have a lot of power through student organizations and through student governance. And yet students are a transient group moving through fairly quickly, as our administrators, right? Students are on like a 4 or 5 year transition where the average tenure of top administrators is 5 years. So administrators need to come in and make a bold move, do that kind of creative disruption, strategic disruption, because they're looking already, the first year they're there, they're looking for their next job. So there's a kind of dynamic where, you know, the faculty are and staff are the ones that are often there for a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades. That's kind of interesting. So some of the things we've done rhetorically, I actually believe, so what Walker's done is he's frozen tuition as they've decreased state funding. In the past, they would decrease state funding and tuition would go up. It's a politically astute move, right? Because the governor can say, look, I saved the taxpayers all this money, $250 million, and I lowered tuition for you students. That's a tactical decision that needs to be looked at. So working with AAUP and our own faculty senate, we've started a campaign called Fund the Freeze. As faculty, I want the education, public education, to be affordable and accessible. I believe in free tuition, because I think it can be paid through military budgets and through corporate giveaways within the state. But if that's not a reasonable thing, reasonable policy at this point, I believe in a tuition freeze, but I believe that the state then needs to fund it. So we've tried to do our own kind of rhetorical propagandistic campaigns, fund the freeze, T-shirts, fund the freeze. We do things in the student union where we'll have grade-ins on Tuesday afternoons with fund the freeze T-shirts and this is the presence of faculty and staff. We also need to look at the disparities between faculty and adjunct or teachers. There's the growing precarious class of the kind of the exploited. I'm not really talking about TAs here, but we call them lecturers in our system. Adjunct, ad hoc hires, short-term contracts. We need to look at their rights as well and build solidarity among that. The hardest thing, though, is to get press on your side. It sounds very whiny for a faculty member to say, oh, they took away my tenure. It's like everybody goes, who else has tenure? That people don't understand it in the public. So how do you tell those stories? How do you, the idea of research, how do you convert that idea of research you do when you have people saying like, well, if y'all wanted, in fact, we had a legislator that said, like this guy in the movie said, why should they be teaching, the ancient mating habits of whatever? That was in the state legislature. Why should they be getting tax money to teach the ancient mating habits of whatever? We thought that was so great that we made a whole website and Facebook site called The Ancient Mating Habits of Whatever. You can find it on Facebook where our local activists put a lot of stuff about education and the absurdity of our state trying to dismantle it.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your efforts as an artist and an activist with the Overpass Light Brigade? Lane did a workshop and a talk today for students around his work here, but I thought maybe you could tell this group a little bit about its successes as well as its limitations. I'm here reminded of a statement from Judith Butler, and she's not the first to say this, but I found this to hand, who said, quote, while demonstrations and assemblies often do not suffice to produce radical changes, they change our perception of what the people is, and they affirm the fundamental freedoms that belong to bodies in their plurality. There can be no democracy without freedom to assemble, and there can be no assembly without freedom of movement and meeting. We were talking earlier today about proposed legislation in various states to criminalize public demonstration and protest. So, but the question is really two-part. Tell us a little bit about what the Overpass Light Brigade is, when it began, why it began, how it went viral, and how it relates to this idea of assembly and peaceful but persistent protest.
Yeah. So, I'll get to that in a second. But one of the things that struck me in this movie was that the story of the UVA of Virginia was a different outcome than the other stories, including of my system. And it appeared to me, at least within the way it was framed in the movie, is the reason it was different was because a broad coalition of people came together to support, in this case, the president. But it didn't feel like it was support of the president as much as the overstepping of authority on part of a highly politicized and I think really quite radical board. So when you look at the dynamics of that, it was the people amassing as a commonality, as they say in protest culture, it was intersectional. That is, it was staff, it was faculty, it was students, and it was community and alums apparently, and it was that power that instantly had effect with that outcome. So given, you know, given that insight, our own work with this thing. So the light brigades are, we invented a kind of neat DIY way of making lighted letters that we spell out collective messages. So if you are online and you do an image Google of Overpass Light Brigade, you'll see what we do. Or if you go home and look that up online, if you've never heard of that before. But this this kind of tactic is really beautiful at night. It's very photographic. It brings a lot of people together to create these messages. It's collective in the sense that individuals hold a letter, but together they make coherent meaning within a phrase or a word. And it's targeted at specific issues and campaigns and messages. So we've done a lot with higher education. We've been doing a lot with water and the environment. We've been doing a lot with immigrant rights lately. But we've done a lot with higher education, where we've gotten the students together to hold letters, fund the freeze, stop the cuts. And then those things go somewhat viral, and we try to use them to both kind of propagate social media with the messages, and also to use that as a way even to give our own administration a little bit of spine within this. And I don't mean to be disrespectful in this way. And I found that within faculty ranks, there's always a few dozen people that will really kind of stand up and be very vocal. And then there's a lot of people who are persuadable. And then there's a lot of people who just don't seem to care, they just kind of go on with their work. In our case, our administration isn't evil. They're not trying to dismantle their own institution. But they're not very strong with it. They kind of need us behind them to say, no, you know, resist these kinds of cuts, you know, resist this narrative, you know, fight for this institution. So in some ways, a lot of our work is as much internal. People say, well, you're probably just preaching to the choir. But preaching to that choir is really important when the choir needs to sing louder, right? I feel like we have work to do in terms of getting students involved to understand that where you are, this place is a contested space, right? People say, well, I'm not into politics. It is a political space, and this movie, I think, spells that out really well. In whatever way you come down on the aspects of higher education, to understand that it is being formed and reformed, right? And then among staff and faculty, to feel like there's some kind of resistance at all, just because it gets really depressing. You know, when you're vilified. I mean, the language about public school teachers was horrible. They're referred to as leeches and parasites, and you know, these school teachers who worked their lives to teach, you know, in tough public schools, and you know, the Act 10 part was just kind of like awful personal attacks. So they need to also feel that there are people that speak out for them in the same way that we see right now with immigrant rights and issues of kind of like who has voice, who has representation, who belongs. I don't know if I answered that, but I probably went off on a tangent, but I think it's all connected.
Just turning a little bit to the documentary itself, the film's director has been accused of offering a slanted view of the issues in some of the reviews. Some have said that financial interests and not political ideology are behind education cuts. One could argue that, you know, financial issues and political issues are intertwined. Others have pointed out that both Republicans and Democrats have defunded higher education over the past decades and more. The director himself said his goal was to let advocates on both sides speak without interruption. So what's your take after watching it? a second time?
First of all, I'd agree with you that budgets are extremely political documents, and they're instrumental political documents. That is, the budgets are really kind of we see it that is what lives or what withers. I also it's kind of odd. Like, I have a colleague who's in climate science. And is if you're a climate scientist, are you political? You do your work, and or if you have a center for climate science, is that center political? According to the way that this one fellow at the end was talking, that would be a highly political thing because that climate scientist is not including the kind of other side of non-human climate disruptive even though there's very little evidence about that, he's not including that. If you teach evolution, are you political? I mean, knowledge is political, right? So I did feel that this kind of had a slant. I felt it was too long. Seemed a little bit too long to me, but I felt that it had a slant, and the slant was towards a kind of, it felt critical of the idea of strategic disruption and what's happening to these public spaces. However, I asked myself, why is that? Would that slant be there? Because when you break down the way that he constructed the film, there really was fairly, it was kind of like an intertitle, one person talking about kind of, one side from all these think tanks, and then a kind of response from the other side. So I don't know.
I think you thought the film was too long because we've lived it so long.
Yeah, we've lived it.
There was an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education a week ago or so, maybe 10 days, saying that that so many people have lost faculty members and others are complaining about losing productivity because of all of the Trump administration and fears about what's happening and reading the tea leaves and being focused on the news and trying to reel from the one thing to the next. And I think you find this a little bit goes on too long because we've been hearing all of this for a really long time. And it does exhaust you as you try to think through and try to respond. But another criticism of the film, and I just want to hear your take on it, is that the film seems to imply, some say, that universities were, until relatively recently, well-supported, idyllic bastions of intellectual freedom. In creating this impression, the film indulges in the tendency to reject the present by pointing to a more perfect past. Idealizing the past might tell a good story, but ignores the long history of political struggle that has led to the present crisis. So could you share your views on that with us?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the question is wrapped a really great point. That is, at what point has university space and educational space not been a site of contention or a site of tension? I think if we look back at the 60s but I also think that they were different kinds of dynamics, right? We can look, just factually at those levels of public funding. And so, I mean, there are, just like data-driven facts that look at these trends in terms of what the public, meaning our tax dollars, used to support and how that is being supported now. University Wisconsin system, we are at 13% public funding. And yet we're at 100% controlled by the legislature. So the state is putting 13% in, but yet has 100% control. That's a fact that we have to live with right now. I will say that it does go beyond partisanship. That is, it has to go to what we feel we want as a citizenry. What are our values with this? Before Scott Walker, I would say among a Democratic governorship, there was more benign neglect. It was still neglect, but it was just kind of like, well, we have other priorities, but you know, so we'll kind of leave it alone, or we'll only kind of defund it a little bit. That feels a lot different than the level of dismantling that we've experienced that I think that this movie talks about. But I don't know that makes a great case for any kind of like robust time before this. It's ever since I've been involved in higher education, it's been a struggle.
You pointed this out yourself, that the UVA story is the one story that doesn't seem to fit because Teresa Sullivan was reinstated. And the director himself said, you know, it's the one that has a sort of happy ending. So what are the state of things in Wisconsin now? Obviously, and I know there's no happy endings, but where are things headed now in your view?
Well, I don't know. You know, this is a great example. She was my colleague last year, right? She had been at and was not. You know, we're friends, but so I can say this that she had a very significant and important role in her ex-institution. Our English department has been a fairly large, robust department. It's one of the more highly ranked departments in the university. We lost 6 people last year. Only one was replaced. A few were for retirement. They get absorbed for these dire budget crises. But a number of them left, and we're seeing that across the institution. People who are mobile, we're losing both our youngest hires who look at the system and say, this is not where I want to make my career future, and we're losing some of our kind of like elder states people, right, who you know, it's kind of taking the cultural memory from the institution as well. Some through retirement who just say, you know, to heck with it. I'll just retire earlier than I thought I would. This is too depressing. Or people like Patrice who move on to a place like this. The thing I would say, though, when I say a place like this, California feels kind of like wonderful right now when you live in, if you have my political leanings and you live in the Midwest. I see things like Governor Jerry Brown says that he'll not give the feds money if Trump goes against the sanctuary status, you know. And you know, I kind of love that, you know, like, you know, people talking about, you know, like ecotopia, you know, new seceding from the Union. Like it feels kind of like a different place. But I would warn, see, I'm like the Ancient Mariner with the albatross here. You know, it's like, arg, don't be like me. You know, let me, you know, I was young once too. You know, I would warn you. Most of you probably don't know about Wisconsin, but Wisconsin has had a 75-year beautiful progressive history. Wisconsin was where the union movement was born. It's where progressivism was born.
The Wisconsin idea was about engagement with community.
And dissemination of knowledge. And it was stunning how quickly it was dismantled. At first, how quickly the unions were dismantled. And it was really weird because he went after the public unions, and you know, we had 200,000 people marching in the Capitol, and it wasn't enough. We had 1.4 million signatures on the recall, and it didn't work. So there was this huge energy, and yet it went on, right? Then he went after the private unions, having told them that he would not go after them. That was the right to work bill. Now, a lot of those unionists in the classic divide and conquer were like 30% of them voted for Scott Walker because he said, I will protect you. And then he went after them. And I went to their rallies at the state capitol, and they were stunned. These are like the electricians and the iron workers and the steel workers and the hardcore union guys. And you could just see they were just sort of stunned, like, how could this happen to us, right? It's always somebody else. Then he started to go after the higher education, which is sort of the campaign right now. And it was shocking how quickly this incredibly robust and famous, globally famous system, particularly Madison, in terms of its ranking, how quickly it has been dismantled. It's still there, still a great school, but it's just really amazing the effectiveness when you have no checks and balances in state government, and you have a very docile press that's not all that eager to actually do serious journalism beyond just kind of these sound bites. So that's where it is. It's not it's a gloomy picture, and finally it's a picture that we kind of. We exported the model to the nation, right? And finally, we all have that same picture, is what is it as people that we stand for? What are our values? What are the stories that we tell? And if we have clarity on that, how do we then tell those stories in a way that's effective enough to move from symbolic protests, which we're really pretty good at, rallies and people in the streets and all that, but how do we move from symbolic to actual instrumental policy, political power? And that seems to be the problem. That is, if we want to save higher education, the question is, how do we get in a position where the people advocating for it are not trying to dismantle it? They're trying to say, we value this as a culture. So,
I mean, one of the things that I think we learned and very intensely was, well, a couple of, with tenure, use it or lose it. And secondly, to be, governance and shared governance. Some faculty mistakenly talk about faculty governance when, in fact, at least in Wisconsin, it's shared governance.
Yeah.
It's not just faculty who rule. It's shared between administrators and students and staff. And yet I think many people become complacent about governance and shared governance because it takes work to be involved in the committees and in the decision-making of the institution. And a lot of people just don't pay attention. They think that's not my job. Really, I've got to get this book out so I can move to the next step. But I think that part of what we learned was the necessity, and this started, since the mid-2000s as we saw budgets declining, that we had to be involved at all levels of the institution if you wanted to really have a voice and come to the table. So. Yeah.
So I was at a rally a couple years ago that Bill McKibben of 350.org, the great environmentalist, was there, and it was a big group. It was in Madison, and he asked, because it was in Madison, he said, "How many people here work at the university?" A lot of people. He said, "Stand up." A lot of people stood up, and he said, "Okay, how many people in here have tenure? Please remain standing if you have tenure. Everyone else sit down." And people who had tenure, there was a lot of them in the room. And McKibben said, "It's up to you with tenure to get on these front lines." Because then he pointed to this whole group of students. He said, "You shouldn't make young people do that. They have a lot more to lose. You have tenure. Use it." And that really made me think a lot of the responsibility of tenure. If we still have it, and some of us are privileged to have that kind of security, then I think that it's up to those of us with that security, or maybe those of us who are more established in our career, or perhaps with less to lose. You say, "Well, I can retire too." We should be the ones taking the the blows and organizing the campaigns, because our young colleagues or our staff and precarious hires and lecturers who are a fundamental part of the institution have a lot less protection. So that's one thing I feel pretty strongly about.
Well, I think we've talked enough. Thank you, Lane, for joining us, and thank everybody for staying in the conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.